Today is the first Sunday of Advent, and Advent is the beginning of the Christian year. During Advent, we celebrate the coming of Christmas. And of course, Christmas is about the birth of Jesus. This is a form of looking back to a time when we believe something very special happened that we don't want to forget. The birth of Jesus is important to us because he is the Christ. Hence, it's appropriate to look back and to celebrate his birth. But traditionally, the church has also understood the season of Advent as a time of looking forward to Christ's final coming in glory and power, when the forces of evil and death will be conquered once and for all, and there will be a new heaven and a new earth, as the book of Revelation prophesies. So then at Advent, we stand between the times. We look back to the past, and we look forward to the future. The word Advent means coming. It can thus refer either to the coming of Christ in Bethlehem or to the second coming of Christ at the end of history. In both cases, however, we are concerned with the meaning of Christ for our lives. Christ is a title, and it means Messiah. Christ is the Greek translation of the Hebrew word Messiah. The Messiah is God's designated representative on earth, who is the herald of God's kingdom, when there will be no more sin and evil, no more suffering and death. The ancient Jews first started longing for the coming of a Messiah after centuries of oppression under foreign rule. They looked back to the glory days of old, when they had a great and mighty king like King David. David was a king beloved of God who ruled over all of the 12 tribes of Israel in a unified kingdom. He was also a brave warrior. You'll remember how he slew the giant Goliath with his slingshot while he was still a boy. He was also a musician and a poet who composed many of our beautiful psalms. What the Jews wanted at the time of Jesus was another glorious king like David. They hoped he would overthrow the Romans and thus restore self-rule to Israel. But they also hoped that this new King David would put an end to all injustice and war on the earth. Such a king would rule on behalf of God, and there would no longer be any discrepancy between the world of politics and God's will for the world. This world would become the kingdom of God, where peace and justice reign together. Jesus proclaimed the coming of God's kingdom and taught his disciples to pray, "Thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven." Some Jews even hoped that God's representative would bring an end to all suffering whatsoever, including sickness and death. Jesus' own healings and exorcisms were intended as vivid anticipations of this new future, since he healed bodies of diseases that crippled them, and he cast out demonic forces that held people in thrall. When the disciples of John the Baptist asked Jesus, "Are you the Messiah who is to come, or shall we look for another?" Jesus replied by saying, "Look at the evidence and judge for yourself. The blind now see, the lame walk, lepers are cleansed, the deaf hear, and the poor have good news." When the book of Revelation looks forward to a new heaven and a new earth, it assures readers that God will wipe away every tear from their eyes, and death shall be no more. So whether it's political and moral evil that we're talking about, such as the Romans represented, or natural evil, such as sickness and death, the Jews, who were longing for a Messiah, were waiting for God to act decisively in order to bring about a world in which human beings could flourish without these threats to their well-being. Thy kingdom come. This vision of the ideal ruler is painted by the prophet Isaiah in the passage that was just read for us. Jesse was the father of King David, and so a shoot from the stump of Jesse refers to one of his descendants. He is described as having the Spirit of God resting upon him, which means that he is full of wisdom and understanding, and he delights in doing God's will. He judges impartially, which means that he doesn't take bribes. The meek and the poor know that he will decide their case with righteousness and equity. Moreover, under his rule, even nature itself will lose its hostile appearance. The wolf shall lie down with the lamb, and the lamb will no longer be afraid. The lion shall eat straw, since it will no longer prey upon other animals. Children shall play near snakes and not be harmed. As the prophet declares, the earth shall be full of the knowledge of the Lord as the waters cover the sea. Such a king is the Messiah. Now, we who are Christians may forget just how odd it was for Jesus' disciples to claim that he was this Messiah. Since the Messiah was supposed to overthrow the Romans and put an end to all injustice and evil in the world, Jesus hardly fits the bill. Although he proclaimed the coming of God's kingdom, he himself was put to death by the Romans, who made a mockery of any claims that he was a king. They placed a crown of thorns upon his head, and above the cross they placed a sign explaining that this man is the king of the Jews. The evil forces that the Messiah was supposed to vanquish vanquished him. He not only suffered death, as we all do, but he was tortured to death in a deliberate act of cruelty that highlights once again the depravity of human evil. And yet, Christians make the odd claim that this person who was mocked, tortured, and executed by the Romans is nonetheless God's vicegerent, God's appointed representative on earth, the Messiah, the King of Kings. But how can this be? The Apostle Paul reports why the majority of Jews have never accepted our messianic claim on behalf of Jesus. He says that for them, this claim is a stumbling block. That is to say, it's offensive. To say that God's Messiah has been defeated by the forces of evil is blasphemous. It's shameful. Paul also reports that most of the non-Jews to whom he tried to preach this message thought it was downright ridiculous. They said it is folly, foolishness. We Christians preach a message that others think of as foolish and offensive. After all, how can God be at work conquering sin, evil, and death through someone who was himself the victim of sin, evil, and death? We need to be reminded of just how odd and surprising our message about Jesus is, and to give account to those who ask how Jesus can be our king if he has no kingdom. I remember as a child looking forward to Christmas. My mother always bought one of those pretty Advent calendars that allows you to open a new flap each day so that we could count down the days leading to Christmas. For me, Advent was primarily the season of waiting for Christmas. And back then, Christmas was about Santa Claus and expecting to find presents under the tree. Although I also knew that Christmas was Jesus' birthday, that wasn't my focus at all, nor should it have been. I was a child. What did I know then about sin, evil, suffering, and death? Childhood is a time of innocence. Once we lose that innocence, however, Advent and Christmas can take on new meanings having to do primarily with Jesus and no longer with Santa Claus. Indeed, it was about the time I stopped believing in Santa Claus that I learned how Jesus had died. When I was 7 or 8 years old, My parents took me to see a movie about Jesus called The Greatest Story Ever Told. It was a big Hollywood production at the time, and I don't think my parents ever thought twice about taking their little boy to see a movie about Jesus. But what they didn't know was I was about to have the biggest shock of my young life. Not only did I not yet know how Jesus had died, but I don't think it had even occurred to me that he had died at all. At any rate, as the hours passed in the darkness of the theater, the movie eventually came around to the part in the story where Jesus' enemies have him killed. Before then, it had also never occurred to me that Jesus had had any enemies. After all, wasn't he the best person who had ever lived? My young mind wasn't prepared for what I was about to see on the big screen in vivid Technicolor. Jesus was brutally whipped, then his hands and feet were nailed to a cross. I was traumatized, quite literally. I had no idea that such cruelty was possible and that it could happen to Jesus of all people. I cried so hard that I could barely breathe, and I ran out of the theater and collapsed in the lobby where I just sobbed and sobbed. Finally, my father came out and grabbed my little hand and brought me back into the theater so that I could witness the resurrection of Jesus. But it made no impact upon me at all. Nothing could take away the horror and the heartbreak of what I had just witnessed. I cried all the way home, and then in bed that night, I cried myself to sleep. I would never be the same person again. I had seen the evil in this world and it had broken my heart. The innocence of my childhood was gone. And this devastating experience left me with questions about Jesus I had never thought to ask before. My experience of watching that movie was very similar to that of the first disciples who experienced Jesus' death at first hand. It caught them completely off guard, and it was a trauma for them. It dashed all the hopes they had once placed in Jesus that he might possibly be the Messiah. As one of these downcast and despairing disciples confessed on the road to Emmaus, "We had hoped that Jesus was going to be the one to redeem Israel, but the clear implication of his words is, but we were obviously wrong. We were wrong about Jesus being the Messiah because, by definition, the Messiah is the one who is sent by God to defeat the forces of evil, not to be defeated by them." You see, it's easy for those of us in the church to take the death of Jesus for granted because we've become so accustomed to it. But until we are able again to imagine the trauma these first disciples must have experienced as a result of Jesus' death, we will never be able to appreciate just how odd, surprising, and even puzzling was their claim that Jesus is nevertheless God's Messiah, through whom God overcomes the power of sin, evil, and death. To be sure, this is not the kind of Messiah most of us want. We would rather see an unambiguous display of God's power and might. Those of us who have grown weary with humanity's sin and moral depravity would like to see the wicked people in positions of high power get exactly what they deserve. We'd like to see the King Herods and the Pontius Pilates of this world taken down once and for all. But alas, this is not what we expect when we turn on the evening news. But just imagine if we could turn on our televisions tonight and hear Walter Cronkite or Anderson Cooper announce that from now on there will be no more war and hatred to report. So too those of us who are worn down by the suffering caused by sickness and death would like to hear that both of these have been eradicated once and for all. Imagine Dan Rather or Wolf Blitzer announcing on the evening news that from now on there will be no more sick people, and that death too has become a thing of the past. But alas, we know that we won't hear this tonight on CNN or ABC. So what kind of a Messiah is Jesus, if he really is the Messiah? Well, for one thing, we can't point to a perfect world and say, see, this is what our Jesus has done for us. There are no objective facts to point to that could prove the truth of what we proclaim. That's why each of us has to make a decision regarding him. The challenge that the Christian message puts before us is whether we're willing to see in this person who met such a horrible fate at the hands of sin, evil, and death, the redemptive love of God that actually saved the world from sin, evil, and death. Like John the Baptist and his disciples, we have to ask ourselves, is Jesus the one we've been hoping for, or should we wait for another? Even the miracles that Jesus enumerates are not proof that he's the long-awaited Messiah. They simply indicate what has been happening to the people around him who have put their faith in him. The blind can see, the deaf can hear, the lame can walk, lepers are cleansed, and the poor have good news. As a result of his ministry, people had their lives transformed. Here and there, goodness triumphed over evil. Here and there, healing triumphed over disease. Here and there, joy triumphed over sorrow. But obviously, that's not the end of this story. At the end of this story, Jesus dies when the forces of sin and evil rear their ugly heads again and put a stop to his ministry of liberating the oppressed, of healing the sick, and of consoling the afflicted. That's why our story of Jesus is such an ambiguous one. That's why the answer to the question whether he is the Messiah is not a matter of objective fact, but a matter of personal decision that each of us has to make for ourselves. That's why our passage from Matthew's gospel concludes with these words from Jesus, "Blessed are those who take no offense at me." You see, if we had lived at the time of Jesus, we could have been offended by what he was doing in his ministry, as were his enemies who sought to kill him. Or we can still take offense now at the foolishness of the claim that he is the Messiah in spite of having been defeated by sin, evil, and death. But if we do decide that he is the Messiah, what does this mean? It means that God saved the world in an odd and surprising way, at least in a way that is puzzling and contrary to our usual expectations. God chose to redeem the world by assuming our human condition with all of its suffering, sorrow, and sadness. God did not remain aloof, standing on the sidelines, being indifferent to our cares and woes, but decided rather to enter the fray of human life. The book of Revelation, when it looks forward to the final coming of Christ in glory, declares, "Behold, the dwelling of God is with human beings. God will dwell with them, and God will be with them." But the Christmas story is that God has already dwelt among us in the person of Jesus. In Matthew's Christmas story, the angel tells Mary that her child shall be called Emmanuel, God with us. Through Jesus, God has given the world a pledge that we are not abandoned, since God knows our condition as human beings and has suffered it with us. The book of Revelation also tells us that on that final day, God will wipe away every tear from our eyes. Yet the Gospel of John tells us that Jesus wept when his friend Lazarus died. The one in whom God has already been with us cried, as we all cry. He felt sorrow, as we all feel sorrow. He even feared death, as we all fear death. Matthew's gospel says that Jesus was sorrowful and troubled as he faced his impending death. And the letter to the Hebrews says that Jesus prayed with loud cries and tears. Moreover, our Messiah not only knew the sorrow and fear of death and had compassion for those who were sick and demon-possessed, but he himself also experienced the consequences of human sin and evil. He was betrayed by a close friend and colleague before being falsely condemned by a kangaroo court, mocked, tortured, and shamefully executed, his naked, bloody body on full public display for all to see and jeer at. And this same one whose life ended in disgrace and humiliation began his life under very humble circumstances, in a stable, in a barn with smelly animals, since there was no room for him and his parents at the Holiday Inn. The Christian message is that the Messiah who will come in power and glory has already come, but in weakness and humility. That the God who will dwell with us has already dwelt with us. That the God who will wipe away all our tears has already shed those tears. The odd and surprising thing about our message is that God decided to save the world by suffering with us out of love for us. For God so loved the world. That's why the Apostle Paul replies to those who take offense at the message of a suffering Messiah and think it's just a bunch of foolish nonsense by saying, "The foolishness of God is wiser than human wisdom, and the weakness of God is stronger than human strength." Martin Luther, the Protestant reformer, always pointed to the cross and the manger as the unlikely places where we should look to find God in this world. God's power is hidden in weakness. God's wisdom is hidden in foolishness. If we proclaim that this baby born in a stable is the King of Israel, that this disgraced criminal on the cross is truly the Messiah of God, then we are making a claim about how God acts in the world to save it, not by destroying God's enemies in a dramatic display of power and might, but by suffering with us in love. That's our Emmanuel, God with us. Of course, like the Jews, we Christians do look forward to the coming of the Messiah in power and glory. But unlike them, we also affirm that the Messiah has already come once before. And because of this first coming, we now wait for that final coming with assurance, hope, and courage, knowing that we don't have to fear the King Herods and the Pontius Pilates of this world. We don't have to fear the suffering that comes with sickness or live in dread of death. Through Jesus, God has given us a pledge that we are not abandoned in this world. Emmanuel, God with us. Although the objective observer will say to us that our king is without a kingdom, since the world is still unredeemed and full of sin, evil, and death, we who have embraced Jesus as God's Messiah believe that the world has been transfigured by his coming into the world. We think we can already see the light dawning on the horizon that will eventually cast away all darkness when it shines with the brightness of noonday. Jesus is God's pledge of good faith to us that God loves human beings and cares about us enough to share our human condition with us. And so at Advent, we realize anew that as Christians, we live between the times, looking back to the first coming of the Messiah in humility and looking ahead to the final coming of the Messiah in glory. Perhaps there are some of you here, however, who enter this season of Advent with mixed feelings. Perhaps there is a twinge of sadness because you remember the joy you once had when there were small children at home who were filled with excitement about Christmas, since Santa Claus was soon coming to put gifts under the tree. Perhaps you long for those days now because, by comparison, it's harder to get excited about Christmas. Since the kids are grown and no longer at home, maybe you wonder, what's the point? Or because with advancing years, your physical vigor is diminishing and you have lost your former youthful energy, Or because with retirement you no longer feel as useful and wanted and needed by others as you once did. Or because at this stage of your life you just can't bear to listen to any more bad news on television each night, with its nonstop reports of even more human hatred and cruelty than you ever thought possible. Or maybe you've just grown weary of life to feel much joy this Advent season, and so you doubt whether there's much of anything left in it for you. But remember what I just said a minute ago. At the time I stopped believing in Santa was when I learned about the death of Jesus. The kind of Christmas celebration to which we all look back fondly with nostalgia is only possible because of the innocence of childhood. Whether we recall the joy of Christmas that our parents gave to us when we ourselves were children, or we recall the joy of Christmas that we gave as parents to our own children, that kind of joy is about innocent childhood, which lasts but a season. For the church, however, Christmas is not about Santa, it's about Jesus. After Christmas each year, Santa returns with his reindeer to the North Pole, where he lives with his elves making toys for next year's visit to the children. Jesus, however, went from the manger at Bethlehem to the cross in Jerusalem. Only adults who have lost the innocence of childhood can truly understand and appreciate the church's story at Christmas. That's why the real meaning of Christmas this year is precisely for you, for those of you who are sad or tired or worn down and weary. Only those whose eyes have been opened to the realities of evil and sin, suffering and death can really share the longing for a Messiah and a kingdom of God. During this Advent season, all of us here can look forward to something that far outweighs any nostalgia we may have for Christmases in the past. The greatest gift of this season is the one that all people are deeply yearning to receive, but it cannot be purchased at the shopping mall, and it won't be found under the Christmas tree. That gift is none other than Emmanuel, our God with us, in the past, in the future, and even now, between the times.